Up to five. Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine. My name is Bill McCann, and I'll begin with it from the talk section, the interview, David Mark. Marchese. Neil Gaiman knows what happens when you dream. In recent years, the word storytelling has been thoroughly absorbed by the language of commerce, reshaped into self-aggrandizing doublespeak for selling, which only increases the countervailing need for storytellers in the more artful, ancient, and magical mold of Neil Gaiman, who conjures fictions that stir up our primal fears and darkest desires, our subconscious yearnings and unspoken fantasies. Whether he's turning death and dream into flesh and blood characters, as in his classic comic series, The Sandman, populating the modern world with figures from ancient myth and fiction bestsellers like American Gods and Anansi Boys, or conjuring eerie new children's fairy tales and ghost yarns, Stardust, Coraline. The British-born author's genre-jumping writing is a constant reminder that the stories that linger longest, that move us most profoundly, are often the ones that can't be turned into means, but function as ends in themselves. Myths and stories are how we have made sense of the world for as long as we've been wandering the planet, says Gaiman, 61. Who helped oversee Netflix's long-awaited The Sandman series, which premieres August 5th. And right now, making sense of the world is somewhere between difficult and impossible. David asks, for the last 5 years, we've been living through what feels like almost unfathomable turmoil. And I think a lot of people see this period as an unprecedented chapter in the human story. But when it comes to stories, I basically believe in Ecclesiastes, there is nothing new under the sun. So my question to you is whether you think we are living in a new story or is it just new to us? Gaiman, this reminds me of something that happened after the September 11th attacks. When we could fly again, I flew to Trieste, Italy for a conference. I remember going into a display of Robert Capa photographs taken in that area during World War II. Until that moment, I had regarded World War II as being unimaginably distant in time. It was this thing that had happened in history that had happened to my family. Basically, all of them were killed. A couple of outliers made it to England. But that was history. That happened then. But there was something very strange about looking at those Robert Capa photographs post 9/11, because they made me go, these people are us. I feel the same way today. History is now, but I'm also getting more obsessive about human beings over huge swaths of time. Part of that came out of being on the Isle of Skye during the serious UK lockdown. On Skye, if there's a rock somewhere, it's probably because somebody put it there. I realized that the rock that I was using to keep the lid on my dustbin was a stone that had been dragged around. People have been in this place for thousands and thousands of years, and in this bay I'm living in, they've left behind rocks. Realizing that about rocks makes you take the long view, which is that the human race is mostly people just trying to live their lives, and that bad shit is going to happen. That then moves you into other territory. Which is what? The territory of Rudyard Kipling, a very unfashionable writer, an incredibly good writer, not always somebody I agree with, but thank God I'm allowed to read him. He wrote a poem called Natural Theology, which begins, I ate my fill of a whale that died and stranded after a month at sea. There is a pain in my side. Why have the gods afflicted me? Then a verse goes, my privy and well drain into each other after the custom of Christendie Fevers and fluxes are wasting my mother. Why has the Lord afflicted me? And after several more verses, it goes, we had a kettle. We let it leak. Our not repairing it made it worse. We haven't had any tea for a week. The bottom is out of the universe. That poem is Kipling going, we blame the gods, the stories, for the shit we do. And we don't always understand it. I would love to think that we're living in a world in which the story of progress, as in the original Star Trek series, is always upwards and onwards. And even if there will be mad times, eventually we get to the bridge of the Enterprise where all the problems of Earth have been sorted out. But I don't know that we ever will. We're humans, and we do our collective insanity really well. David, you just thanked God for being able to still read Rudyard Kipling in spite of what he's now widely seen to represent. That makes me think of how in the past you've referred to yourself as a free speech absolutist. During the same time period that I mentioned in my first question, we've seen so much evidence of the harm that people can cause when they're allowed to spew whatever they want in public forums. Has seeing that affected your absolutist belief about free speech? Let's drill down into this. Do I believe that the New York Times should print the opinions of people who, whether because I'm a Jew or because I don't believe in everybody's God-given right to shoot AR-15s, want me dead? No, I don't. Does that mean I'm not a free speech absolutist? No, it doesn't. What it means is that you get to decide where and how opinions are stated, and that you have your certain recourse, including arguing, including mocking, including saying, no, we're not printing that, including saying, you're not on Twitter anymore. So then what does it mean to be a free speech absolutist? I think what I've said is I'm a First Amendment absolutist, which is a slight difference. Coming from the UK, where you have an Obscene Publications Act and an Official Secrets Act, to America, where you have a First Amendment, it's like, this thing is good. This thing is right. You'll always wind up in places where you are morally uncomfortable with what you were defending. But you better defend that stuff, because if you don't, then nobody who is morally uncomfortable with the stuff that you're making is going to come out for you. I once wrote a thing called Why Defend Freedom of Icky Speech, about a guy who was going to be sent to prison for having Japanese comics depicting big-eyed kids doing sexual stuff. You're not even sure if they are kids, because they're big-eyed Japanese drawings. But I will defend his right not to go to prison for owning this stuff, because this is not child pornography. Child pornography is a bad thing. This is drawings. If you're saying that what happens on paper is real, then if I kill somebody on paper, I should be punished for it. And that's obviously not true. Now, here's the biggest free expression. It's complicated, that I've seen as a result of the online world. One Nazi in a town probably doesn't make much noise about being a proud Nazi, because they know that they live in a town full of other people who, if they found out this person was a Nazi, will disapprove. That is a good thing. On the other hand, because of the online long tail that one Nazi can hook up with the one Nazi in the next town who does the same, who does the same, who does the same, suddenly they see there's a lot of them. Do I think there's an easy way to stop that? No, I don't. David, another thing the digital world unleashed, it's a new dynamic in the relationship between artists and fans. It used to be that the two had pretty minimal interaction. Now, because of social media, fans are almost expect access to the people who make the pop culture they love, which the artists, especially in the superhero sci-fi fantasy worlds, seem happy to oblige or scared not to. What are the ripple effects of that shift? It always seems to me that you do yourself no favors as an artist by putting yourself on a pedestal. All that means is you're shouting down at people. You're not standing there in the street talking to them. The good things about Sandman came from talking to people, came from my friends, came from looking at things and going, I didn't know that was a thing. I'm going to put that in my comic. But I was always lucky in that what I was making was weird and out there. Sandman has been huge, but it was never huge when it was coming out. Since then, it has gone on to become this ridiculously steady bestseller because new people are always finding it when they're 16, 18, 22 years old. They find it, and it's their comic. It's their story. I didn't get to that by going, I will please my audience. But audiences do want more of the last thing that they liked. That's how audiences work. They say, hey, I love this strawberry ice cream. Can I have more? In response to that, I can do one of two things. I can give them more strawberry ice cream. If I do that, I'm doomed to give them strawberry ice cream for as long as I do this thing, and I will hate myself. Or I can go, nobody is clamoring for chocolate ice cream. Nobody even knows they like chocolate ice cream. However, I want to do chocolate ice cream next. So why don't I do chocolate ice cream and keep my own interest up? It's how the entirety of my career is gone. I'll use another analogy. Years ago, my friend Teresa Nielsen Hayden said, some authors are dolphins and some are otters. You can train a dolphin, give a dolphin a fish if it does a trick and it will do that trick again. Otters are untrainable. They'll do something and you give them a fish and then they'll do something else. Because why would they do the thing they already did? I tend to be an otter. The Sandman may keep finding new readers, but do you think those readers keep finding a new thing in it? Because the themes of the comic are all to do with foundational, timeless human stuff. Dreams and dreaming, death, destiny. Do those themes resonate differently to people watching a Sandman Netflix show in 2022 than they did to people reading the comic in 1989? I am absolutely fascinated by the number of things that I did in the 80s and 90s with Sandman that are now getting yelled at for being quote-unquote woke, which I have to say in the context of Sandman is a fascinating word for people to use. When our casting came out, we were accused of, you woke people are doing gender quotient stuff because you cast Gwendolyn Christie as Lucifer. I created Lucifer in 1987. I found photographs of young David Bowie as a folk singer in the 60s and sent them to Mike and Sam, the artists, and said, Lucifer needs to look like this. I made it very clear later on that Lucifer was sexless. We see naked Lucifer. There's nothing between Lucifer's legs. When we went to cast it, we were just looking for who would be fabulous. I loved Gwendolyn's Tidiana in A Midsummer Night's Dream. She was incredibly powerful as Brienne of Tarth. I thought the combination of beauty, brilliance, and the fact that she will tower over Morpheus. Okay, getting people shouting at us because we're gender swapping by casting Gwendolyn as Lucifer left me utterly baffled. David, what do you think explains the impulse of some fans to not only disagree with the character's race or gender being changed, but to also voice that disappointment so venomously? It's become so common for fandom to curdle into toxicity. The people yelling, I'm not saying none of them read Sandman, but a lot of them appear to be grumpy Brazilian followers of that country's current president who don't appear to have much vested in the story. A lot of them also appear to be people from the Comicsgate cult, which if you ever want to read an unfortunate 15 minutes researching something bizarre, research Comicsgate. These are people with agendas. There's a difference between the people going, you are a communist-inspired tool doing the money-led dictates of your Netflix-inspired masters. And to pick another example, the people going, after we'd cast a black actress as Death, oh, I'm not sure I really like the pale, cute little gothy Death from the comics. Those are two different things. So David says, the problem is that sincere fans are being conflated on social media with this other toxic cohort. Exactly. The truth is, they break down into two categories. Fans are the ones where I'll go, hey guys, this isn't the comics. And they go, okay, we'll see what happens. And then they're the ones who are like, you are ideologically tainted by your satanic masters. And why are you, a Jew, even writing about Lucifer? My personal Lucifer from the Bible does not look like this. I don't think of these guys as fans. Fans, on the whole, are significantly less entitled than you might imagine. David, then I hope you'll indulge my version of an entitled fanboy's question. My favorite of your books is The Ocean at the End of the Lane, which you've been explicit in saying was inspired by your childhood. But you were raised in Scientology, and you only ever give glib answers when people ask you about it. You've always been willing to talk about the influence of other things, Midrash or various authors, but not Scientology. Seems impossible that Scientology wouldn't have shaped your imagination somehow. And to me anyway, the subject seems to hover around the edges of The Ocean at the End of the Lane. Sorry, I realize none of this, that is a question. The question is, in what ways was Scientology a formative influence? Because it must have been. The easiest way for me to answer your question is that I don't have a control version of me who did not have Scientology growing up. It's much easier for me to talk about the influence of Judaism. But why? I don't understand. Because Judaism was something where I can go, okay, here's me growing up until I'm 11, and then here's me being sent to London, initially every weekend, and then for all of my school holidays to stay with my frum, which is a Yiddish word meant to connote being religiously observant. My frum relatives in Harrow and Reb Lev teaches me that at the time I assumed was the standard Jewish education for every kid getting bar mitzvahed. I didn't discover until my mid-20s when I started having conversations with other Jewish adults who were bar mitzvahed that not everybody was taught about Adam's three wives. That when the Messiah returns, we will be in this giant tent made of the skin of Leviathan and eat the flesh of Behemoth and Leviathan in the back room. There will be the women having Jewish babies and then coming back out with their maiden heads magically restored to stop the feasting and take the men off to have sex again. Then they'll go back and have more Jewish babies. That's the weird stuff I was taught. I was fascinated by this stuff that I was handed between the ages of 11 and 13 as one giant wadge of myth and belief and story. I can look at that and talk about it in the same way that it was much easier for me to be English and write American Gods. Because I came to America and went, has anyone noticed this stuff is weird? And people go, what's weird about driving a car onto the ice every winter and then waiting for the ice to melt and the car to fall through? I'm like, no, this is weird. But growing up with two parents who were Scientologists, I have no control, no version of me that didn't. What I do know is that I definitely grew up in a world in which being a science fiction writer was a good thing. As far as my parents were concerned, that was an incredibly esteemed profession. So you're saying that Scientology is to your bar mitzvah instruction as, to pick a weird English thing, Morris dancing and maypoles are to the rituals of small-town America? The first part of each analogy isn't strange because they were your birthright, and the second part is strange because you came to it late? Absolutely. Morris dancing and maypoles are completely normal to me. Bible stories, totally strange. Going clear makes total sense. And then that was David. David said, Bible stories, totally strange. Going clear makes total sense. Going clear is a term used in Scientology for the process of overcoming one's reactive mind and achieving full mastery over one's irrational behaviors and insecurities. Yeah, going clear was the world in which I was raised. Leaving that world was interesting, but it was also, what am I saying here? Sometimes I only realize how weird things were in conversation with my wife. It's just stuff you take for granted. For me, ocean was a way of inspecting what I thought about my childhood. But it was also me trying to recreate the landscape of my childhood, because the landscape is not there anymore. I think it was Guillermo del Toro who told me the story of his storage unit. The credit card it had been on expired. Nobody told him, and his treasured stuff had been sold. I thought, that will never happen to me. Ocean at the end of the lane was a way of being able to say, none of this world is there. The buildings don't exist. The pond doesn't exist. But this was my childhood. This is where I was. This is who I was in that world. David, do you think our strangest, most powerful experiences can even be explained in any sort of straightforward way? Like, you write a lot about the powerful hold that dreams have on us. What if tomorrow you saw a newspaper headline that said, scientists determine the exact nature of dreams? Would that change things for you? Approximately 40 years ago, I remember being incredibly upset by seeing somebody holding a newspaper, an English tabloid, and the front page headline was, Werewolf Captured in South End. My heart sank. I thought, I really hoped a werewolf had not been captured in South End. Because if a werewolf had been captured in South End, then the werewolf would have moved from the realm of dream and myth to the realm of reality. I would never again be able to imagine a werewolf to be whatever it is that I need a werewolf to be. That would be the worst thing in the world. Fortunately, the werewolf was just some guy who was off his meds. David, but werewolves are myths and dreams aren't. Doesn't seem crazy to me to think that scientists could someday solve dreams. If they did, would the Sandman and the character Dream mean something different? I cheerfully read the science on dreams, but I remember when I started Sandman, reading authoritative books on dreams that would explain that people only dream in black and white, or that you cannot hear anything in a dream, or there was an absolutely definitive statement in one of these books from a very authoritative scientist that no dreams have plots or stories. They're random images, but as we wake, we impose a story upon them. Well, I have dreamed in color. I've woken up with tunes in my head brought back from dreams. I've followed stories in dreams. The current theory is that while we are dreaming, the brain is doing something faintly analogous to a defrag. Defragmentation is a process by which data stored on a hard drive is systematically reorganized to improve a computer's performance. But would seeing proof of that change the way that I think about dreams and stories? No. Because Sandman is me going, let's look at all of the different meanings and implications of the word dream and what dreams are. None of that changes if dreams are a defrag process or not. Because it's still true that every night we close our eyes, fall asleep, and go mad. We meet people who are dead and encounter people who never existed and wind up in places where we have never been and never will be. That is the subjective truth, and that truth is real because it's true for us. David, gods, like dreams, figure in all in your work all the time. Do you believe in their subjective truth too? That goes straight back to werewolves discovered in Southend. I would be just as disappointed if God or gods showed up as I would be if I ran into a werewolf. And for the same reason, I'm a creator of fictions. If I need ghosts, I put ghosts in. If I need gods, I put gods in. And I'm under no obligation to put the same kind of ghosts or gods or demons into my fiction twice. I believe in whatever I need to make the story work. Including the story of your own life? Oh, absolutely. There's a story I wrote a long time ago called One Life Furnished in Early Moorcock, which was the nearest I've ever done to a story of my school days. It was talking about growing up surrounded by things that people believed and seeing how all of the stuff seemed like complicated ways of believing things that probably weren't true, but were ways to view the world. For example, a small wafer, literally or only metaphorically, becomes the body of somebody who, if they existed, died 2,000 years ago. And this act of ritual cannibalism is not actually an act of ritual cannibalism. So in response, I'm going, okay, you can believe that. And I'll believe in DC Comics and Roger Zelazny and make a dash of Moorcock. You guys are allowed to believe in that stuff. I can believe in this. Roger Zelazny is a groundbreaking science fiction author among many other books. Lord of Light, a book set in the distant future in which a starship crew become Hindu gods, a clear influence on Gaiman's books like American Gods. David asks, finally, last question. Let me go all the way back to the start of our conversation when you were talking about rocks. You said you were moved by the epiphany that the rock you'd put on the lid of your garbage can had been left behind by another human soul thousands of years before. What's your version of that rock? What are you leaving behind? It's the Sunday in the Park with George question. The entire process for some of us is the Sondheim question, what are you leaving behind? Gaiman. For me, the solution is children and art. I've got four kids. So far as I can tell, I've raised them well, and I've not broken any of them, and they get to go off in the world. Then there are other children you leave behind because you affected them. You made something that touched or changed them. I'm one of the children of C.S. Lewis. I may be a grumpy and rebellious child of C.S. Lewis, but I am a child of C.S. Lewis. I'm a child of Tolkien. I'm a child of Zelazny. I'm a child of E. Nesbitt, P.L. Travers. These are the people who got me at a young age. I love it when I get readers at a young age. So it's all children and art. That's what it is. And I'll read the Screenland section of the magazine. How the Bear captures the panic of modern work. You don't have to work in a kitchen to recognize the chaos and precarity the show depicts. This is a story by Karina Chocano. The original beef of Chicagoland is the fitting name of the restaurant at the heart of the acclaimed FX series The Bear, which stars Jeremy Allen White as Carmi, a world-class chef who returns home to run his family's sandwich shop after his older brother's suicide. Of all American cities, Chicago is the one whose mythos is most closely associated with a particular kind of work, honest, meaty, broad-shouldered labor that forges you into something bigger, nobler. Like the city it's set in, the restaurant in The Bear is an unpretentious place, humbly catering to the working man. But the working man, we soon learn, as a young black female sous chef mocks an older white male manager's use of the label, is a contested term, especially in an environment where nobody does anything but work, and pretty much nobody has anything to show for it. It's unclear at first why Carmi, once named one of Food and Wine's best new chefs, has come back to the sandwich shop, but we're gradually made to understand that he's returning compulsively to a traumatic site. Food was a thread that connected him to his brother, and his brother wouldn't let him in the kitchen. And so off to Sonoma, New York, he went to make something of himself. The original beef of Chicagoland is also Carmi's original beef, the core wound that ignited his ambition. The sight of his connection to his family as well as his estrangement from it. The story of the prodigal son returning from some summit of achievement to his salt of the earth hometown is a beloved American narrative, most often seen in Christmas movies about frazzled executives returning to their roots. They're intended to reify the comforting notion that work isn't everything, that the real America is slow, simple, cozy, and above all, fair, a place that rewards you for your efforts, full of wise, avuncular coots and simple, patient girls who've been waiting all along. And when Carmi returns to Chicago, he finds his elders are either absent or trying to exploit him. And the only girl who's interested in his feelings is his sister. Just as success failed to save him, honest work won't either. It won't even generate enough money to get by. The original beef may signal noble, can-do labor, but it's also a decompensating system on the verge of structural collapse. A few episodes in, the toilet explodes, unleashing a geyser in Carmi's face. An industrial mixer blows a fuse, knocking out the power. The gas goes out, forcing the kitchen staff to build makeshift grills outside. They have no choice. One missed lunch service could take them out. A 1980s arcade game called Ball Breaker blares stupidly, violently from one corner, handily summarizing the experience. "Your balls have been broken," its screen announces. "Continue." The Bear has been praised for its visceral depiction of the stress of a professional kitchen. But you don't have to have done restaurant work to recognize the chaos, panic, and precarity the show captures so convincingly. In The Bear, work is a dumb, sadistic game that has left Carmi with unchecked PTSD. Intrusive thoughts and flashbacks fracture his consciousness. He even cooks in his sleep, almost setting his house on fire. Richie, the restaurant's manager, takes Xanax because he suffers from anxiety and dread. "Who doesn't?" Carmi snaps. Sydney, sous chef, has a cabinet stuffed with medication for heartburn and ulcers, problems that may have been sparked by a failed attempt to run her own business. It was the first time I didn't have a complete and utter psychopath behind me screaming," she says. "And I thought I wanted that, you know, but look where that got me." The restaurant is drowning in bills. When the characters aren't yelling at one another at top volume, they're often shutting down to cope with all the yelling. Their customers are like kids stuck in a car with warring parents. The word you see most frequently in writing about the show is stressful, but it's often accompanied by descriptions of the workplace as soul-crushing, toxic, or abusive. All this is intended as praise. The idea is that, despite its occasional excesses, the show has captured something relatable and true. Hustle has always been romanticized in American culture, which promises that nobly sacrificing yourself on the altar of endless work will pay off in the end. But it's increasingly clear that for most people it won't. 22 years ago, when Anthony Bourdain published Kitchen Confidential, he glamorized the kitchen as a kind of foxhole, populated by wild, dysfunctional hard-asses yelling profanities at one another while managing to crank out hundreds of plates every night. This may once have seemed exotic or picturesque, but that pressure cooker environment has come to feel familiar to more and more workers in more industries. The American economy soared after the past decade, but life for most became harder. In one of the best decades the American economy has ever recorded, families were bled dry by landlords, hospital administrators, university bursars, and child care centers, Annie Lowry wrote in The Atlantic in 2020. For millions, a roaring economy felt precarious or downright terrible. The Bear is compelling not because of how it recreates a kitchen, but because it captures something about modern work in general. Carmi and Sydney work insane hours, rising at dawn and waiting for L trains on dark platforms, too exhausted to think about anything else. At times, it seems as if work is how they escape from having to think about what is happening to them. Sydney tells someone her goal is simply to do her job, live her life, but it's abundantly clear that outside her job, she has little life to speak of. These conditions don't spur creativity. On the contrary, they're counterproductive. Carmi can't spare time to listen to Sydney's ideas about the dinner menu or encourage the pastry chef's experiments with donuts. Exploring your talent in this environment might turn out to be another luxury the working man can't afford, something that belongs exclusively to narcissists with financial backing. This inequality comes into focus early in the show. We see Carmi abused by an arrogant chef and in Chicago paid a visit by his mobster uncle, who talks down the restaurant. The place is unfixable, he says, before trying to buy it for himself. Carmi is furious to learn that Richie has been dealing cocaine in the alley behind the restaurant to keep afloat. But Richie justifies his actions by co-opting the language of entrepreneurship, crediting this side hustle with getting the place through COVID. That's the kind of stick-to-itiveness and ingenuity and out-of-the-box thinking that we look for in employees, he says. But that ship has sailed, my friend. This is the startling milieu and message of the bear, the thing that has struck a chord. The notion that hustle will eventually pay off is an insidious pipe dream. Everyone is in survival mode all the time. The system has failed. The place is unfixable. Now I'll read Judge John Hodgman on Satin Sheets. A couple disagrees about which side should go up. Renee writes, "My husband and I have a debate about how to put our satin sheets on the bed. He claims the sheets should go on the way they're meant to, meaning the silky side face. I say they should be flipped so that the softer side is on top of us. Who's right?" And the judge writes, "I don't like satin sheets because I don't like sleeping on a slick, glossy cloak of unicorn tongues. But that's me. If you like getting slippery in your sleep, you should absolutely get that shiny side of the top sheet against your skin. But what does your husband like? Because right now it feels to me as if he might be pulling that classic husband trick, disguising his personal preferences as universal laws. So while I do rule in your favor, I encourage you to ask him if he really likes satin sheets or if a compromise is required. Remember, satin pajamas exist, as do plain, non-tonguey cotton sheets, or what I call sheets." And now I'll read a letter of recommendation. "I collect souvenir spoons." I can explain. Those airport gift shop mementos are a link to the past and to future trips my father and I might have shared. It's a story by Hannah Sellinger. For 3 years in the 1980s, my father, who was a partner at a class action securities firm that bore his name, had an ongoing legal case in Oregon. As a child, I had no idea what this meant, only that he often returned to New York from his long business trips with two things: a stupid dad joke and a tiny spoon purchased in the gift shop of an airport. An afterthought, sure, but it was something. We were almost always apart, my father and I, from the time I was one, when my parents separated, to the time he died when I was 30. But spoons were always arriving for most of my childhood, souvenirs I wanted badly, almost as badly as I wanted to be alongside him on his journeys. There was a trip my father and stepmother took to Hawaii with one of my younger sisters. There was, too, his solo white water rafting adventure in Arizona. He kept his own souvenir, a photograph from that trip in his trim office, where by day he was a clean-shaven attorney, and by night the kind of men who departed for weekend forays down the Colorado River. From his second honeymoon in France, he brought back a spoon adorned with a petite replica of the Eiffel Tower. Later, other people brought me spoons. My stepmother's father, Irving, who retired from the Postal Service, started a second unofficial career as a world traveler, which is how I came to own spoons from airports in Israel, China, Japan, and when it still existed, Yugoslavia. As at my father's house in Westchester, more than 200 miles from where I lived with my mother in northern Massachusetts, the spoons hung in curio cabinets on the walls of my bedroom until I went to college. Then they were stored away in a closet until I stopped collecting and they grew dusty. I forgot about the places I had never been to and flew off to actual real-life places. In the United States, souvenir spoon collecting dates back to the mid-1800s. The first American souvenir spoon, produced in the late 1800s, was outfitted with George Washington's profile. By the time the Chicago World's Fair arrived in 1893 with its 27 million visitors, spoon collecting had become a pastime. It's impossible to say what people collecting spoons a century ago were thinking, but I like to imagine that then, too, it was a form of aspirational travel carried out through gifts from family and friends. Perhaps those armchair travelers may have been no different from the toddler waiting at home for her spoon to arrive and for the world to unfold through the magic of finely etched silver or nickel. I felt then, as I do now, that these spoons, with their careful embellishments, displayed a level of artistry that other keepsakes couldn't match. I loved the scalloped edges of the Windsor spoon and the motor car atop the one from Detroit, details that brought me joy in a way that a gift shop shirt or a vial filled with pink sand from some tropical beach never did. From 1988 to 1998, I flew between Boston's Logan Airport and New York LaGuardia every other weekend, a regular route carved into me by divorce. Added up, this accounted for approximately 108,000 total miles flown, with not a single spoon purchased from either airport. Instead, I have spoons from other places while I was living life away from one parent or the other. I found my spoon collection again recently on the heels of a move. They were still in their cabinets, which were never quite right, and so I ordered the appropriate ones with hitched notches designed especially for them. A long time ago, when my father delivered these spoons to me, he was, as I saw it, promising something, that we'd see these places together. Eventually, I was promising something in return. My father retired at 54 with the intention of traveling the world. At 55, he was diagnosed with ALS. By 57, he was dead. In the final weeks of his life, I asked him to tell me about the places on his bucket list. But then we both knew we wouldn't live to see the Canadian Rockies, the cliffs of Ireland, the magnificent green-lipped seas of New Zealand. Not long after his death, I booked a solo flight to Auckland, a destination he had shown me on the computer after speech had become impossible. I brought his ashes with me. I didn't buy a spoon. The house my father and stepmother shared is sold now. He has been gone 11 years this July. Old childhood treasures have been traveling back to me in stages, boxes delivered haphazardly with old memories inside. My five-year-old son had never seen them, these memories of places that I've largely never visited. I watched him run his thumbs over my spoons. Paris, with its ridged Eiffel Tower, and our own New York, city of my birth, with its cherry red apple on top. My son has taken to collecting spoons himself now. His first, the Virgin Islands, was a proud addition to the cabinet. And he likes to look at the collection much the way I did, not as a mark of where he has already been, but as a mark of where other people have vicariously transported him. They're a way of keeping my father alive in the eyes of a grandson he never met. He was here, I can tell my son, holding the one from Hawaii with the ersatz pineapple. It's a tether, however tenuous, between now and then. He was right here. Hannah Selinger is a James Beard Award-nominated writer based in Massachusetts. Now I'll read from The Ethicist. Can I ditch my roommate so I can live with my friend? The magazine's Ethicist columnist on what you owe the person who lives with you. I'd been living in my apartment for a year when my current roommate moved in. We didn't know each other beforehand, but she has turned out to be a nice person whose lifestyle is very similar to mine. As roommates go, she's a good one, and I have no complaints about living with her. But I just found out that one of my best friends is moving to my city in a few months, around when my lease expires, and she and I would like to live together in this apartment. Problem is that I don't think my current roommate has any desire to leave. In many ways, the apartment is mine. I was here first. The apartment is stocked and furnished with things I bought, and my name is the only one on the lease. The roommate wanted to sign a lease, but because my landlord already knew me, he preferred to keep our current arrangement. We ended up just signing a sublease agreement between us. Of course, none of that is my roommate's fault, and after living in the space for a year, she must feel a certain claim to it. Is it wrong of me to tell her she needs to leave at the end of our lease? And if not, how do I broach that conversation? The Ethicist writes, your roommate's legal rights will be determined by local statutes. I'll leave that to the lawyers. But the ordinances of morality have a wider bailiwick. So does your roommate have a moral claim to stay on? As you say, you were there first. You selected her as a roommate and offered her a place. You have the relationship with the landlord. To speak formally, you're the primary or master tenant. She is the subtenant. Your sublease agreement comes with a fixed term, an expiration date. This is morally, not just legally, significant because it sets reasonable expectations with mutual obligations. And it isn't as if you're proposing to break the sublease early. Suppose that you, as primary tenant, were to marry or have a child. Nobody would think you owed more than fair notice to a roommate who had been around for a year. Simply having held a fixed-term sublease doesn't create a substantial moral expectation for renewal. If you had both been there for many years, a presumption might develop that both of you had some kind of claim on the place. But she's not been there long, and you have a reason, a bestie, not a baby, but still, for asking her to leave. When it came to formalizing your relationship, you did so in a way that permits you to ask her to move on. She has a sublease that she can't unilaterally renew. Given that she has been a good roommate, you owe her as much notice as you can imagine, so that she can have ample time to find a new place. You also owe her courtesy in explaining the situation. You'll be better placed than I am to decide how to broach the conversation. Depends on the relationship you have and what sort of person she is. But let me mention a general point. You can regret certain consequences of a decision you've made without regretting the decision. I'm truly sorry. I missed your wedding, but my wife went into labor. In this case, you can sincerely express regret. You feel bad about inconveniencing her without saying or thinking you're at fault. You're not wronging her. You are acting without malice and for an intelligible reason. I think I'll read another John Hodgman. Jackie writes, my credit card offers access to airport lounges and covers fees for expedited security privileges. My boyfriend refuses to get expedited clearance because he is a man of the people. When we travel, he enjoys the benefits of lounge access, while I get the benefit of waiting for him after security. Please order him to accept my offer to pay for his pre-check. And the judge writes, there's something dystopian about a system that separates people by wealth into those who deserve to be treated as humans and those who must take off their shoes. But as a pre-checked Diamond Medallion Sky Club member, I'm never going back. We're all situational hypocrites. So I don't begrudge your boyfriend too much for deadbeating off your lounge access. But if he can't acknowledge this and shut up about it, stop waiting for him and meet him on the plane. See you in the club with the other monsters. And I'll end with a poem. Final poem from my father, misnamed in my mouth. And this poem was selected by Victoria Chang, and the poem's by Philip B. Williams. And Ms. Chang writes, this is one of many final poems in Philip B. Williams' latest book, Mutiny. These poems, with titles like Final First Poem, Final Poem for the Crow, and Final Poem for the Black Body, are beautiful in their language and their subversion and rhetoric of questioning. They seem to be self-empowering in their farewells to oppressive tradition, standards, systems, and structures. In this poem, the speaker grapples with the grief of losing a father who was missing while alive, but in death feels omnipresent. The heart of the poem lies in the question and possibility, even if that possibility once only had one wing. Final Poem for My Father Misnamed in My Mouth by Philip B. Williams. Sunlight still holds you and gives your shapelessness to every room. By noon, the kitchen catches your hands, misshapen sun rays. The windows have your eyes, taken from me your body. I reorder my life with absence. You are everywhere now, where once I could not find you, even in your own body. Death means everything has become possible. I've been told I have your ways. Your laughter haunts my mother from my throat. Everything is possible. Father light washes over the kitchen floor. I try to hold a bit of kindness for the dead and make of memory a sponge to wash your corpse. Your name is not Attic or Sir. This is not a dream. You died and were buried three times. Once after my birth, again against your hellos, shedding into closing doors, your face a mask I placed over my face. The final time, you beneath my feet. Was I buried with you then? I will not call what you had left anything other than gone and sweet, perhaps. I am not your junior, but I fell in love with being your son. Now what? Possibility was a bird I once knew. It had one wing. Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine. My name is Bill McCann.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aincolorado.org or by calling 303-786-7777.